If my voice holds out, I want to stroll with you this morning through the traditions of our people. I want to talk about names. I want to talk specifically about one man's name, Jacob. And I want to suggest what the changing of a name can mean. And in passing, to suggest the reach, the changes of character and personality of which we are all capable. Now, the ancients, as you know, set great store by names. Names were ultimately significant. A parent chose for his child a name which would protect the child. It was called a theophoric name, a name which bound the child to the child's god. When a king ascended to the throne, he was given a royal name, which invoked the protection of the gods or promised great glory to the king. It was customary for a man and for a woman, when they reached a certain maturity, competence, to change their names, to be given a new name, depending upon their rank, or some special talent which they had shown, or some special quality of person. You were known by your name in a very fundamental and basic way. Names were not simply, as we use them, convenient labels, addresses, to distinguish one from another. When the Pharaoh Amenhotep IV ascended the throne of Egypt, he was given this royal name, which means he who pleases the god Amun. But when, several years later, the young Pharaoh became involved in a bitter battle with the established priesthood of Amun, and he took away their privileges and destroyed their temples and rededicated the kingdom to the solar disk Aton, he took on a new name, Akhenaton. And Akhenaton means simply, it goes well with the god Aton. This is the famous Ikhnachaton, the pharaoh who brought Egypt for a very brief moment to a vision of one overreaching and overarching god. When our father Joseph was a young man, he was given the name Yosef, which means simply, may he have increase, may his future be a good one, may there be many descendants from him. And when he ascended into authority in Egypt, when after interpreting the dreams of Pharaoh, he managed to win for himself the second highest office in the Egyptian bureaucracy, the Egyptians gave him a new name, symbolizing his rank and his position within Egyptian society. The Bible tells us he was called Zaphnat Paneah, which means the god Ashenat protects. When Terach named the first of the patriarchs, Abram, he gave him a name which means Aviram, my father is mighty. And when God enters into a covenant with Abraham, he lengthens the name, and the name becomes Avraham, which is interpreted by the Bible as meaning the father of multitudes. Out of Abraham's seed will come many, many generations and many tens of thousands of people. The changing of a name was a matter of significance. It meant one had changed one's rank, one had changed one's role, one had changed one's god, or one had changed one's personality. Now, names retain a certain amount of significance. If you look at the role of names in modern life, you'll see that we have tended to change our last names far more than our first ones. When our grandfathers or great-grandfathers came to these shores, they shortened the names that were familiar to them in Europe. They assimilated European names to an Americanized environment. When our fathers went from Europe to Palestine to Israel, they did very much the same thing. In order to be rid of the diaspora and the diaspora names, they Hebraized these names. And so Gurion became Ben-Gurion, and Meyerson became Meir, and Shertuk became Sharet. They gave to themselves names which signified a new role, the independence of the Jewish state. And I've noticed, as you have noticed, that a growing number of our young women, when they marry, are unwilling to give up their original, their maiden names, and so they create a hyphenated last name, the last name of their family and the last name of their husband's family. It becomes quite a mouthful sometimes, but it's a way of asserting that my roots are as important as your roots. But it intrigues me that all these changes of names in modern times have dealt with roots, have dealt with the background, rather than with one's own personality, the first name, the thing which most distinguishes us. And I wonder at this, because when you look at ancient tribes, when you look at the American Indians and groups of like such as that, you find that whenever the young person went through a rite of passage, he won a new name, or she won a new name for herself, depending upon her speed, or his strength, or her good looks. And this name became the adult name. The child was left behind, and a new adult person had emerged. And I wonder if this indifference to name changing as it relates to our first names may not relate to something very pervasive in our society. The fact that we really do not believe deep down that whatever that we can overcome our conditioning, overcome our environment, that we will remain in adulthood very much what we were conditioned into becoming in our childhood. This is Freud. This is a whole tendency in modern life to see ourselves as emerging slowly out of childhood, but never really being transformed, changed into something other, another person requiring another name. Now, the ancients believed that, in fact, the adult was something more than a grown-up child. The child isn't the adult, but a grown-up, an adult, is something more than simply a child with a few years of experience and a few inches on him. And I think that's true. I think that wisdom is more significant than our contemporary conventional wisdom. For that is certainly true that once we go through what some of the modern psychologists are calling an identity crisis, once identity confusion has been resolved and we gain our adult identity, we become very different, really, than we were before that moment in time. Nepachta li shacher, the Bible describes it, I've become a different kind of person. And no greater mistake can be made by friends than not recognizing that the 40-year-old is far different than the child we remember from 12 and from 15. As I look back upon my own childhood, many of the young men and young women whom my children would describe today as turkeys, a turkey I've discovered is the youngster who's always out of step, who's never quite with it, who's always got their neck up, craning and looking around, but you're never quite sure, you know, what they're thinking or what they're doing. Well, the turkeys of my generation turned into fine human beings. And if I were still to judge them by what I knew them to be when we were all young, or if they were to judge me by what they knew me to be when we were young, I think our assessments would be largely inadequate, incorrect, and misleading. We do change. We do change in terms of temperament, in terms of character, quite radically, if in fact we manage to grow up, to become adult. And yet something deep down in the modern psyche prevents us from simply going down to probate court and changing our name to correspond to these changes in our individual personality. Now, all this is by way of prologue. Prologue to a discussion of a name change in the Bible, how Jacob became Israel, a name change which I'd like to suggest to you speaks to the reach of human possibility, of human potential, a process of change described by the Bible with remarkable fidelity to the changes which in fact take place in the emergence of our individual personalities. Now, the Hebrew word Yaakov, Jacob, probably comes from a root which means Yakub El, May God protect. But the Bible gives it a different etymological base. It takes it from the noun ekev, which means heel. And we are first introduced to Jacob as one of twins, the younger of the two twins, Jacob and Esau, who, as he is being delivered, comes out holding on to the heel of Esau. If you remember your Greek mythology, you remember that Achilles had only one weak spot, one place where a spear or a sword could enter his body. Achilles, according to the Greek legend, was the son of a noble man, Peleus, and of the goddess of the rivers, Thetis. And Thetis wanted to protect her mortal offspring, and so she took him and held the infant baby when he was just born over the river Styx. This is the sacred, magical river. She held him by the heel, and she dunked him in the river, and wherever the waters covered the child was impregnable. But where she held the child by the heel, the child could be wounded. And when Achilles went off to the Trojan Wars, he proved invincible until finally, as you know, someone discovered his Achilles heel. Now, the biblical story of the two twins is nothing more than a statement in legendary form that the younger twin would somehow discomfort the older. He knew the older's weakness. He would best the older throughout life. It's a storyteller's warning to us of what is yet to come. But the word heel, as applied to Jacob, is true in another sense. In the modern jargon, he was a heel. He was not a nice human being. The young Jacob was a rather overly shrewd young man, conniving, timid physically. We are introduced to Jacob first off in a scene which is almost impossible if you put it in the context of ancient times. We find him in the kitchen, in his mother's kitchen, with an apron around his waist, cooking. Now today, a young man has to learn to cook or he's going to starve. But in those days, for a young man to enter the kitchen was a statement of effeminacy. It was not his role. There were sex-differentiated roles, and this was not the place for the young Jacob. But there he is, puttering around with the pots and the pans, making lentil soup. And Esau is out in the fields doing what young men are supposed to be doing, hunting, riding horses, you know, being very, very physical. And he comes in hungry, famished from his exertion, and he sees his brother with the lentil soup, and it smells good. And he says, "Let me have some." And immediately we find the shrewdness of the young Jacob emerging. Jacob says, "Certainly, here, I'll give you some, but you must first promise me the birthright. That is the double portion of the inheritance, the leadership of the clan." Now, Esau does not possess the birthright as yet. His father hasn't given it to him. I think he probably felt that Jacob was bantering with him. And he says, "Of course, I'll sell you my birthright for the mess of pottage." And Jacob says, "Swear to me." And he swears to him. And he sells the birthright in a symbolic way for the soup, which satisfies for the moment his hunger. And all this, again, is an introduction to the actual conniving by which young Jacob gets the birthright. Young Jacob is not only a shrewd, manipulative human being, effeminate, but he's also a very pliable, malleable person without a mind of his own. His mother preferred the youngster who was smooth-skinned, who was always around the kitchen, who didn't smell of the field of the hunt. The father preferred the more athletic, the more masculine of the boys. And there seems to have been some kind of bitterness in the house between the two parents. But in any case, one day, when they're in their early 20s, the mother, Rachel, overhears the father, Isaac, now an elderly man whose eyes are going bad on him, call Esau to him and say to Esau, "My son, the time has come for me to speak the ritual blessing which invests you with the birthright. I've decided you are to be the chief of the clan and my heir, but I must have some venison in order to eat the sacred meal, the ritual meal prescribed before I pronounce the blessing. So go out in the fields, hunt down a deer, bring in the deer, cook it, prepare for me the meal, and I will give you my blessing." Rachel overhears this conversation. She summons the younger of the twins, Jacob, and she says to him, "This is what has transpired. I want you to go to the flock and find me a couple of goats, and we'll slaughter the goats, and I'll make a fine stew for your father. And you will go in, and since he's hard of see, he can hardly see any longer, he will give you the blessing, believing you to be Esau." Now Jacob doesn't protest. He's ready to take this act. But he says to his mother, "The scheme won't quite work. I'm smooth-skinned, and my brother is of hairy skin. My father will feel us, even if he can't see us, and he'll know that I am not Esau." The mother said, "Well, that's easily solved. We'll make for you armlets out of the skin of the goats, which are hairy. You'll put them over your arms. When your father feels your arms or feels your shoulders to put his hands and blessings upon them, he will feel that you are, in fact, Esau." And so it transpires. And the young Jacob is given the blessing, which cannot be recalled, the birthright, which once given cannot be rescinded, and becomes the titular heir of the family. Esau, of course, feels deceived, but he can't take immediate vengeance upon Jacob because his father is still alive. He has no right to do so. He bides his time, but the mother knows that there will be a moment of violent anger, of murder, and she orders young Jacob to flee. So far, we have a perfect description of a young Hebrew juvenile delinquent. Nothing to commend him, nothing to suggest that Jacob will turn into one of the fathers, one of the patriarchs of our people. He goes off by himself. He goes off into the mountains to go north to the homeland of his people in Syria, to Laban, his uncle. And that first night when he is away from his father's home, this young man who was always underfoot in the home, never out in the fields, he must have felt cold and lonely and frightened, but we're told simply that he lay down without a covering. He took a stone for a pillow. He went to sleep. And suddenly that night he had a dream. And in that dream he saw a ladder, its foot on the earth, its top reaching into the heavens. And he saw angels of God ascending and descending the ladder. And he heard the voice of God speaking to him from the heavens. And the Bible tells us, "Vayera Yaakov." And Jacob was frightened, awestruck, overwhelmed. And he said, "Hine yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh, v'ani lo yedati." Surely God is in this place, and I had no sense of it. There comes a moment in every one of our lives when we're leaving our adolescence and we're entering adulthood, when suddenly we recognize that there is reason to fear. We are now responsible for our own destiny. We are now alone. We know that the voice of God speaks to us. There's nobody to run home to. There's nobody to throw our responsibilities on. And the world suddenly becomes an alien, strange, and foreboding place. And that's the beginning of the transformation. We've left the home, we've left the womb, we've left the security. We can no longer blame anybody else for what happens to us in our lives. We suddenly recognize that we are alive, that we are independent, that no one will take care of us, that there is this relationship between God and man, between responsibility and myself, and that I must somehow assume that responsibility. And that's the first moment. If you think back to your childhood, you can probably remember that moment. That first moment where we begin to transform ourselves into something other than what we were as a child. The recognition that the security of the home is shattered forever, and that we've got to walk and make our own way. Now that's not the completion of the process of becoming an adult. That's only the beginning, the first step. And no one begins to become an adult until he's gone through that devastating, that emotionally devastating experience. Vayera Yaakov, where you're suddenly frightened by life and of all its implications, frightened by the responsibilities. How am I ever going to make my way? How am I ever going to make a living? How am I going to ever decide what to do? There are no answers as yet. Only the desperate questions, and only the sense that there is an overarching judgment which somehow relates to us. Now, as you know, Jacob goes on. He returns to the homeland of the people in Syria, to his uncle Laban. And there, in a very neat bit of measure for measure, tit for tat justice, the younger who took the elder's birthright is made to take the elder daughter for a wife, when in fact he proposed to marry the younger daughter, and Laban informs him that in our world, this is the way we do it, that the elder must always be deferred to. He's made to sense the guilt that was his because of his act. When he comes to Laban's territory, he goes to the well, and he sees this beautiful girl come down to draw water for the flocks. This is Rebecca, and he falls in love with her, and wants to marry her. And he says to Laban, "What can I do to deserve your daughter for my bride?" And Laban says, "Work for me for 7 years." And he works apparently willingly for those 7 years. And when it comes to the bridal feast, there's a great gathering of the clan, and the bride is bedecked and veiled as all Oriental brides are, and she's led into the marriage chamber, and only the next morning does he discover that he has been sleeping with his new wife, who is not the younger daughter, but Leah, the older daughter, because the older daughter, by traditions, must be the first to be married. In anger, he explodes at Laban, "What must I do? Why did you do this to me?" Through storms we grow, through being taken advantage of, we learn to take care to a certain degree of ourselves. And Laban said, "It's easy. I'll give you the daughter whom you want to be your wife, but you must promise to me to work 7 more years in order to earn her as your wife." And so he works for 14 years for these two women, and then he works for Laban another 6, trying to establish himself to get capital, sheep, goats, camels, all that he will be able to take home. Between the first moment, the first shattering moment when we recognize that we're on our own, that it's a cold, alien world, and we've got to somehow make it our own, to the moment when we're ready to go back home, that is, when we're ready to become adult, to live with other adults, to be with those whom we left behind, because at that point we were not yet ready to act the role of the grown-up. A number of years have to pass, years when we're away. It's no matter of happenstance that it's part of our common wisdom that our children ought to go away to college. They ought to be out from under. And probably they ought to remain away for a number of years, however much we would like them to be around, until they can come back and treat with us as equals, as adults. A very difficult role for any child to establish with a parent. 20 years have passed before he hears God say, the voice of conscience say, "Return to your land and return to your parents." And he sets out with his large retinue. He has 2 wives and several concubines and a number of sons and a daughter. And he begins to move back south towards Canaan. And as he moves towards the south, he begins to wonder, "How will I be received?" Now, he knows that his parents will receive him with open arms, at least his mother will. But what about his brother? The brother who is physically stronger than he, the brother whom he defrauded. How will his brother receive him? And as he moves along through the Transjordan down towards the passage across the ford across the Jordan that he will take to enter the promised land, he begins to wonder, to worry, to be anxious. And he sends ahead a messenger. And he tells the messenger, "Go to Esau, my brother, and tell him I am come with many possessions to share my possessions with him, and I want to be received well by him." And the messenger goes and returns. "What said my brother?" "Your brother said nothing, my lord. He said only that he was coming to greet you with 400 armed horsemen." Worry, anxiety, fear. Have I the courage to cross over, to expose myself, to really be an adult? And so as he approaches the ford in the river, he divides his possessions. And he sends ahead at about 2-hour intervals, first a large flock of goats as a gift, and then a large flock of sheep as a gift, and then a large flock of camels as a gift, and then a large flock of horses as a gift. And he tells to the drover, to the man who is guiding each of these separate flocks, Tell my brother Esau that these are for him, only part of the gifts which I want to bestow upon him. And one by one, these gifts are sent out, bribes, if you will. And finally, the ford is come to, and he orders his household, all his familiars across the ford, and he remains there alone that night. Shall he cross the Yabbok, the Rubicon, or shall he not? And that night there wrestles with him a man, and they wrestle unto the morning. And the man says unto him, I cannot overcome you, and you cannot overcome me. What is your name? Jacob. And the man wrestles further, and he cripples Jacob in the thigh. And Jacob said, I have wrestled with God and with man, but I have not been fully overcome. And the man says to Jacob, let me go. And Jacob says, I will not let you go until you bless me. And the man says, from now on, your name will not be Jacob, the heel, but Israel, Yasar El, he who has wrestled with God, with man, and has not been overcome. Now, is this a dream? Was Jacob simply wrestling with his conscience? Was the attempt to portray Jacob wrestling with an angel of God, or was he wrestling with God himself? The story is difficult in the sense that we're not told precisely who this dark, unknown, anonymous assailant was. Surely we can project ourselves unto this moment. For can't we not remember a moment in time when suddenly we wrestled with our conscience, we wrestled with our fears, we wrestled with our anxieties. Oh, they got the better of us for a time. But somehow we overmastered them. We crossed the Rubicon. We crossed the ford. We crossed into adulthood, never to return to childhood. And there you have the beginning and the end of this period of transition from childhood to adulthood. It does not come overnight, despite what all our children like to believe. It takes a long time. It takes many, many difficult experiences. It begins with a shattering awareness that we're alone, we're on our own. It ends with the awareness that we can wrestle with our fears and not be mastered by them. We have put our need for security of the home behind and can now really develop our energies and direct our energies as an adult. And it's at that point when the identity confusion has become a clear sense of our own identity, to use Eric Erickson's terms. It's at that point that we emerge into ourselves, and it's at that point that in traditional societies, a person adopted his or her adult name. Because now they knew themselves. And isn't that what adulthood really is? When you begin really for the first time to understand yourself, the child reacts almost instinctively. The adolescent has a different crusade every other day, a different passion every other month. But the adult has settled convictions and settled concerns and knows himself. He's been changed in the process. We are no longer as innocent, no longer as perhaps as sensitive as we once were. Jacob was crippled by this night of wrestling. He limped forever after. But whatever the cost, and the transition from childhood to adulthood does demand of us a cost. We have grown, we have matured, we have emerged. And you know, I've always been rather proud of the fact that we are called the B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. I often wondered why of all the patriarchs they called Jews Israelites. Why wouldn't we call Abrahamites or Isaacites or Josephites? Why Israelites? Jacob, when we look at him as a young man, was not a very nice young man. But I suspect that the name was chosen because we too as a people have had to wrestle through many a long night, wrestle with our fears, fears of the oppressor, fears of the crusader, fears of the enemy outside, fears of the majority, and we have not been overcome. We've been blooded, we've had our martyrs, we've been denied many things, but we've not been overcome. We persisted. We wrestled the long night. We emerged as a truly committed community. truly committed B'nai Yisrael, the sons of Israel. Amen.